here, Dr. Kiefer Boyd, and do anything else that you might want to do while you're here. I'm very pleased to introduce Karen Kiefer Boyd, who is a professor of art education and women's studies, and has been here at Penn State for, what, 10 years? Is it a little more?
A little bit, yeah. Okay.
And she is really primarily responsible for cultivating a very close relationship with Judy Chicago, and I think letting her know, maybe telling her that Penn State would be a wonderful place for her art education archives. So I'm really thankful that you are able to help bring those here. And she is going to be talking about feminism's past?
Future of feminism's past.
Halfway right. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Karen Kiefer Boyd.
Thank you. Well, greetings. I'm so pleased that you are here and to hear about Judy Chicago. I'm going to provide a bit of a context, and so that we can actually look at the themes that Judy Chicago has been working on throughout the past 5 decades. The show surveying Judy Chicago 5 decades. What I'm really focusing on a lot is her conversation with her younger self, and also in relationship to the themes and the issues and how do they relate to today, and how we might look at these concerns that she brings up in the 1970s to today. And just briefly about myself and my own interest and fascination with Judy Chicago's work. As Dana said, I'm Karen Kiefer Boyd, Professor of Art Education and Women's Studies. And in the 1970s, I got my Bachelor's of Fine Arts from the Kansas City Art Institute. When I graduated in 1978, it was after I graduated, I picked up Judy Chicago's Through the Flower. It was her autobiography, and it resonated with me. I had many of those same sexist experiences from the Kansas City Art Institute. While I loved my education, there were these some obstacles, and when I read her book, it just resonated with me, and I realized that I was not alone. In fact, she had dealt with this journey prior, and she had started the Fresno Feminist Art Program and had rethought a different kind of education. And as I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts, painter and minor in printmaking, I realized that in order to change things, I too needed to rethink my education, but also make a difference for other people's education as well. That's sort of a trajectory of turning my course in finding some freedom and liberation in art education that I could also work with my art, but that's where I found the propulsion in order to make a change, to make a difference. And so I've been working on that since the 70s, and here I am the past decade here at Penn State trying to do that as well. And one of the things... Judy Chicago then has been a role model for almost 5 decades, but in the past decade has been more of a mentor. And there's a series of events, and I coldly just emailed her if she thought that feminist art pedagogy could be brought into the online environment. And she said, absolutely not. But she was welcoming with the kind of research as I described this, and she invited that I could come and interview her. I went to New Mexico. That was in 2002. She invited me again in 2003 to sort of be part of a planning process for when she was teaching others her pedagogical process, and I became very familiar with it. Now, in 2009, as she came down the stage of a talk, she saw me and she said, I've changed my mind. I think it can be done, and I want to work with you. You know, so that kind of happened about then, so we've had this connection, and so I must say that Judy Chicago has become not only a role model and continues as a role model, but also a mentor in the past decade. 2010, she calls me about something a little bit unrelated to what I was about to ask her, and I asked her, well, what are you doing with your teaching materials? Penn State would be a fantastic place. We have the Lowenfeld collection. We have the National Art Education Association collection and archives. Wonderful, research university art education program is like the top or one of the top in the nation. And she liked the idea. That was 2010. By 2011, we had agreement and endowments, and I am so thankful for Judy Chicago's generosity in giving us the collection that is in the archives, and that exhibition will open in mid-March. And I also thank Through the Flower for their generous donation of endowments that helps to support some of the programming that you're seeing around the show. And part of our planning was to have the symposium and, of course, have this exhibition during this time. So this is sort of a route that has inspired me to continue to learn more and more. And I have dug into the archives of her journals of her art making that are at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard University. And there's what I found is that her art making processes, she had to sort of redo those, rethink that in the 1970s, and started this feminist art program and moved on to Woman House, and those processes informed her art making. And I want us to look at, when we look at the artwork here today, I want us to think about the processes that go into making these works, because the process is in some ways very explicit to its meaning, and some ways metaphoric to the meanings of the work. And sometimes we don't look at process in that way. I want to begin, first to reiterate that the focus of the talk is Futures of Feminist Past. And the prompt that there's a little slips of paper over there on the table, and to carry on the conversation beyond the hour that we have together here, there's this prompt, and the prompt says, what have you discovered in Chicago's work that is still a concern today, and how might we change it in the future? So that's sort of the focus here, and what I hope to do is to provide a context that you may discover in the work issues that Judy Chicago has been concerned with, how they are or are not still present today, and what we might look at to how we can change that, but also the power of art to do that. What role does art have in changing our future? Judy Chicago very much believes in the power of art to change our attitudes, to transform society, and she still has that belief. And I want to begin with this work here, which is the newest piece here. It's 2013, so very, very new. This whole series here along this wall is a series that she did between 2009 and 2013 that revisits the themes of her art in the 5 decades. She's continuing to think about, in this first one over here, about freedom, liberation. What does that look like? And when we look at these works today, I want you to think about if there, what might a feminist power be? What are feminist symbols that are coming out in Judy Chicago's work? There's a progression pretty much in chronological order of the kinds of themes that came out, but I want to start here, and then we're going to come back around the room this way here, but you'll need to come up closer to see this work at some point here. And what it says along her arms here, it says, you can read it better here, let's see, she said, for the unlearned, old age is winter. For the learned, it's a season of the harvest. She's revisiting a series in 1993 to 1994, an autobiographical series, but in this point she's interested a fairly new interest in aging. As you know, Judy Chicago turns 75 in July. She's looking at aging here, but she wants to, which we all really need, and particularly women need, to feel that there is, that we don't become devalued as we age. And so she's another a role model here of having us think about aging woman, that it can be a time of harvest. And just think of what we've read and what we've done and what we can share with others. There is wisdom that is often discounted in aging women or elderly women in this society that has not been the case with men. She also, in her mouth here, is the word truth, like where her teeth might be. And I think about in terms of speak truth to power. And this has been an activist call that came about from the Quakers in the mid-1950s, as that's where it actually came from. But it's then been picked up by feminists in the 70s and throughout, and others, about speaking truth to power, standing up against the dominant systems, the dominant power. And from her mouth, she is speaking this. And we'll see other places how the mouth and what the mouth speaks in some of these other works, how she is continually trying to speak truth to power through her work, but maybe somewhat literally here with the truth coming right out of her mouth. With that, it's very interesting that a photograph, could you hold this a second? A photograph that her husband, her third husband, Donald Woodman, took of Judy Chicago, and I can pass this around, I'll hold this up here, and you'll see she's wrapped with a hose, an airbrush hose. Now this was a photograph taken, I think, 2010, and when he took this photograph, they were asked by the, and I can pass it around with this, well, I'll hold it for a moment, and then as I speak about it, and then I'll pass it around. Judy Chicago, the Swerve magazine is an insert in the Toronto Tribune, a Canadian newspaper, and they asked for a cover, and she thought, she has a great sense of humor. And so she thought she would go out into her own garden, and the one who does her is her hairdresser, so he did her hair. She went out there, her husband took this photograph of Judy, and wrapping the airbrush hose, which is reference to these works back here on this wall, going back to the 70s, because this notion of using the airbrush, she wrapped it around, and it's Eve in the garden, so we see the apple in her hand, but it's the idea of her. Now, she thought, like, of 2010, so very, very recent, so she's in her 70s, and she's, feeling proud of her body. I mean, some as we age, we don't even want to look in the mirror, but we should. We should look in the mirror. We should be proud of what we look like, because that is who we are, and our body changes over time. And she gives that example. Now, this image was actually censored. Not by the Swerve magazine, the editors of the insert, but by the newspaper. They were just afraid people would be too shocked to see a naked woman at age 70. It's just, so Judy Chicago continues to be very, very controversial, and in fact censored, and sometimes by silencing and omission. And that is one of the issues that she continually works with within her works of trying to speak what is silent, speak truth to power. She's trying to bring that out. So now I will pass this image around as you come on over. And
did you say it was censored? Was it covered or was it just not published?
It was not published. And I should say that what she has done is made it available
image, and you can download it off the internet, and you can have this image. So it is, and it becomes a symbol of fighting against censorship and erasure. And so it becomes that kind of symbol. So in that way, it was censored. It just was not published on the cover, even though Swerve magazine really would have wanted it to be published. But yeah, it's just going out in a daily newspaper, and or maybe it was the Sunday, paper of that, of a weekly paper. So do you mind holding?
Yeah, sure. Whatever.
These kinds of lifesavers for her. her father died when she was 13. And in her journal that I read when I was at the Schlesinger Library, she writes that about her father's death. He died, disappeared, abandoned me, and I keep thinking the same thing will happen now. And this is when she's working on the dinner party. She says, "Can I go forward in the face of all the risk, the probable deaths, the uncertainty, the shaky support?" Those are her words. She got married at age 25 to Jerry Jerowitz, and he was killed in an automobile accident at age 23. So at age 23, she is widowed. And she writes that she struggled to emerge from the stranglehold of so much loss and grief. And so in some ways, the symbolism behind this is of lifesavers is really part of that, is very much at that time period there. Now, she also did something else around that time period. She graduated with a Master's of Arts from University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, in 1964. Her husband died just a year prior, and after that, she married Lloyd Hemrill, but she didn't take his name. Instead, she decided that she would take the name Judy Chicago. Now, it was partly because a gallery owner kept calling her because of her Chicago accent, kept calling you Chicago, you know, Chicago girl, Chicago, you know. And so she, and also they thought that would be a good sort of, it was actually the gallery's idea to have her in a boxing ring fighting the art world, basically, and in this pronouncement of her changing her name. So there's first this statement out here, and it's written over here, that that she, Judy Jerowitz hereby divests herself of all names imposed upon her through male social dominance and freely chooses her own name, Judy Chicago. And there was a series of photographs done of her in a boxing ring. And it's not actually this photo, but I love this photo. But it's a photo of her in the boxing ring. Muhammad Ali is where he trained, which was also, she thinks about the spaces where she's at. You see other women are benefited as the support and the changes that she has done in the art world and as role model behind her. Her gallery, the gallery director is behind her as well in this photo. This was published in art form in 1970, and it really brought a recognition to Judy Chicago that was nationwide, that brought her to attention in ways others could not. But for years afterwards, male artists would come up to her and want to say something about, you know, do you want to box? So she got kind of tired of that. But anyways, but look at this photograph here. When I have talked with students and we've done some performative activities and exercises, we think about, so what does a feminist look like? Well, one of the things that often comes up is about taking space. You know, often you sit in a bus in the subway and you're sitting really small, crossing your legs, all this, and this man is sitting next to you, you know, and I've, you know, been in New York and you just can't even, you know, fit on that seat there, and, you know, it's like, oh, no, get some space there. And look at how she is sitting here. She is, and I'll pass this around, and she is taking space there. So maybe that is an example of what a feminist looks like. While she's working in during this time, she talks about, and I'm going to read a quote from her, she describes her experience at this time, and she says, "After nearly a decade of what I describe as male drag, that is making art that disguises the gender of a female artist, I rebelled, and I sought to unite my gender and my art making by constructing a feminist art practice that encouraged, rather than discouraged, young women to explore their own experiences as potential content for art making. To accomplish this, I decided to retrace my own steps in college by setting up a program that would also liberate me from the professional constraints I had developed during my first decade of professional art practice. Although I was both aware of and frightened by the risk I was taking, I am not sure I fully realized what a radical step I was about to take. So she was very dismayed with the patriarchal system, and she not only developed a pedagogical programs to teach others, but she also educated herself. And that's what we start to see in this piece over here, in this time period here. This is after her teaching projects at the feminist art program in Fresno, which was then moved to Cale Arts, and where the teaching project Women House, often known by many people, came about. So this is 73, and she decides to, she needs to go into the studio, she needs to work, but also what she's doing is she is reading biographies of women, literature by women, looking at art by women. She is looking for clues how to aid her to have the strength to continue and to create art and to have a confidence in that what she is doing. Because what she was creating art about, and particularly in her from her professors at school, was considered when she did butterflies and flowers or breasts, it was considered silly and superficial and kitsch, not serious art, these kinds of things. And so she wanted to still create art from her experiences, and she looked in this education and how to do so. So she also reveals a lot about herself and puts that out for the rest of us. And so we see from her experiences insights that we could not by the kinds of abstraction, particularly at this time, that was still quite prevalent. So while she's working on this series, The Liberation of the Great Ladies, she keeps a journal. Now, we are so fortunate that Judy Chicago is a prolific writer. She has many published books, but also she keeps a journal. Typically Saturday, she writes. And it's those journals that have been have fed into her art, like in this piece here, because these are excerpts that she also asked herself, am I brave enough to put this on canvas? And I can read you one that I would think she's pretty brave to put this on canvas here. But she, you know, wonders, am I brave enough? And then, you know, sees that from this personal experiences, it might be something that is shared with others. And so she actually puts this as a personal experience out there and starts to see larger social ramifications for what it is that she's thinking and she has experienced. So in this piece, in the first part up here, she talks about how she has had to tape, layer, mask, because this is very, it's airbrushed, but it's also, you know, a lot of taping, so you only go in some areas there. And she talks about sort of, it's very frustrating, much like women's lives, about buried, layered, masking, taping, silencing, these kinds of things. And so she thought about the process, as I mentioned earlier, the process becomes very important to understanding the metaphorical meaning and sometimes literal meaning of her works. So here she's talking about the words up here are frustrated and frustrating. As we get to this stage, I'm going to read her words here. And like I said, these come from excerpts from her journals, and she decides what she's going to put up here and brave enough to put up here. I put my finger in my pants and up my vagina, pulling out a bit of leftover menstrual blood. It was dark and somewhat thick. I didn't realize it was still on my finger, and I accidentally smeared it on the masking paper while I was working. I wrote that when I first started this picture, and I've been wondering ever since if I would have enough nerve to include it. You know, who really wants to share that? But yet, I think there's probably many women that kind of like, oh my God, you know. You can relate to this experience. I think so. Her words are embarrassed, embarrassing. And when you relate to those experiences of menstruation in one way or another, typically, probably every single one of the women out here can remember something embarrassing about menstruation. And this is speaking to, you know, a larger kind of perspective and something that is not talked about. She talks about several different things, but that comes out in these two spaces here. This one here has to do with the notion of women, and she's at a time period in the 1970s here where women's sexual pleasure, orgasm, you know, people read books how to have, women read books, you know, our bodies, ourselves, how to have an orgasm. I talked to one of my professors who said, that's how I figured it out. I had to read a book, you know. And so this was a time period like this. And so the kind of, you know, denial of sexual pleasure, and then on the other hand, this sort of like idea that only men really want sex and that's what women's role is, to have sex but not to have sexual pleasure. So the words hypocrisy and hypocritical are the terms here, and it's relating to those kind of bigger ideas. And the final idea down here that she writes about and projects within this image here is like this beautiful, remember her birthday's in July, beautiful summer day, it's her birthday. She works really, really hard, if you haven't figured that out from looking at all of this work here. And she really wants to have a really good day. You know, a birthday. Who, you know, I do that too. I try to set everything aside in that, you know, my birthday, I'd like to enjoy that. Well, that's what she wanted to do. She went out on an outing, and the one of the companions with her, a man, kept talking about his problems, and wanted her to focus on him, support him. As she said earlier on, she maybe always has gotten used to reassembling her life for the needs of a man. By this time, she's saying, no. You know, and she speaks out, I wanted to have a good time, so he went home, and his wife went with him, and she continued, and having a good time and trying to enjoy herself, but then, you know, feeling like the expectation that she is supposed to support, nurture, take care of man's needs. So in this Liberation of the Great Lady, she's kind of working through these kinds of things, but it's also, she begins to, like I said, study many, many women, looking for all these different role models to actually give her some clues. By the time she creates this piece right here, 2007, this is 73, this is her talking back to her younger self. And here, she's revisiting the pieces about the great ladies and her, she did sketches and such, and of course the great ladies, the liberation of the great ladies evolved into the dinner party. And you'll see the sketches of the plates there and a plaque over there just talks about the dinner party as well as some of the test plates and sketches, mock-ups for the runners underneath the test plates. But in this piece, Fused Mary Queen of Scots in glass. You know, you're looking at all sides here, and she's revisiting, because at first, when she was younger, she thought about that, you know, women were going to be able to transform and bring a justice and equity to the world, and she had that belief, and that's why, you know, she's looking to that. By the time 2007, and her experiences in her life, she recognizes that everybody has potential for cruelty. So she recognizes, she's, you know, somewhat dismayed about that it's not going to be women that are going to save, but that actually everybody. And she refers in this piece to Elizabeth I, who signed the death warrant for her sister, Mary Queen of Scots, So in that case, you know, your own sister to kind of, to, you know, this. And, you know, there, within this, and that's the writing that goes around the edges here. So her journals, you know, do become part of her work. And but we also can, you know, see when you come upon this room, it's sort of glowing. You know, it's there's always a sense of optimism and hope. One of the things, and one of the things I totally admire about Judy Chicago and why she's a role model for me, is she just does not give up. And if anything, you know, we can see that she does not give up. The dinner party was in storage for almost 30 years before it got out and into the, not until 2007. It's so much controversy about it that it was pornographic and obscene and just the notion, as you'll see those plates there on the back wall over here and some of the other imagery around here that the idea that it's a bunch of like 39 vaginas on the wall and how simple and superficial that is. Well, she talks about when she hung out with the men in the 60s, the male artists, they were at the Beanery coffee place in Pasadena, and she talks about the greatest derogatory comment would be, you cunt, and they were saying it to men, you know, so it was like calling men cunts. And so she's like sitting there, it's like, well, what happens if you actually have one, you know? So she's, you know, got this, you know, so what do I do with that? So I'm going to take that, as she said, as she thought in her mind, she was going to take that and try to not, it's not about explicitly about the biological aspects of a vagina, but it's about the symbolism that is something that we can be, women can be proud of being a woman and what we can contribute from that perspective, that there's a lot to contribute from that perspective. So with that, I want to just come over here to this piece, again, that Dana talked quite a bit about this work, and I just want to add a couple more things to it because it will relate to how we're starting to look at these, and toward the end I want to have conversation at the last couple pieces that we're going to look at, but I want to give this context first. And so here we see this work about birth, but it's called Earth Birth. So it's again symbolic of a larger kind of birth, and it's another way to look at the creation story, so to speak. And look at where it's glowing. Look at where the yellow, the areas that it's glowing. Speaking from the mouth, the air. From the womb, from the breast, nurturing, feeding, from the hands having, being able to create and do, and from the environment around us. So the yellow becomes really significant to the story of this idea of creation. Now, she says, remember I said how, and she draws from her experiences. So people critique this and, you know, and she's saying that, well, all of us have been born, right? So we all have that experience. As Dana mentioned last class, last gallery talk, she didn't remember about being birthed, and probably most of us can't really quite remember that as well. But it is an experience that we all had. But people, when they then say, well, what are you doing paintings about birth when you don't have any children? You have not given birth. And a response is, well, you haven't been crucified, or many artists haven't been crucified, so why are they doing artworks about crucifixion? You know, they can do that, and so that's an experience that sometimes we have experience, not necessarily bodily, but we actually have that experience by the mythology or the religions or the beliefs that are around us. So she really thinks it's very valuable to have
different kind of representations, different kind of ways of talking about issues that have not been talked about greatly, or they have only been talked about in a very narrow, singular way. So she's trying to think about birth in a way that relates women to a larger kind of cosmos kind of perspective. But think about this breathing here and the mouth area here coming out of the mouth. And I want to come to this piece over here. Three faces of man. Now, I'm particularly thrilled with this because I was contacted about this piece and about appraising, which I don't know, although I could say I can appraise it and say it's worth a lot. but anyways, in that kind of conversation, through email and then eventually by phone, they were looking to have it appraised, and they were downsizing. They were Ruth Lambert and Henry Harrison were moving from their home in New Haven, Connecticut. And so I again said, well, Penn State, Palmer Museum of Art, what a great place. Wouldn't you want to donate this to Penn State? So this is our first work by Judy Chicago in the Palmer Collection, and it just came 2013. So this is now ours to see. The other work will travel and go back to the owners that were kind to lend it to us for this exhibition. So this Three Faces of Man, this triptych, comes from this series, Power Play. It comes just prior to the debate on Congress floor about the dinner party, in which the Congress people, all men really at that time, talked about the pornographic and obscene sexual art that Judy Chicago created, and really said very derogatory things about the work. Just prior to that, and in this time period here, this power play, she was thinking about how power actually disfigures people. It sort of contorts and disfigures. So this idea of power disfiguring and distorting, and we can kind of look at this as we get down to this cartoon of the fall down over the way here. Here, these faces. Now, in this power play, this was before there was a body of work around masculinity studies and around queer theory. And it wasn't until it was reshown in Santa Fe in 2007 that there was really the kind of attention that could actually be attended to it, because she was dealing with theory in practice before the theory was actually written. Jonathan Katz's catalog essay is available over there in the study area of this exhibition, and I highly encourage you to read his essay about the power play works. But one of the things that, and David did bring us to this piece, but one of the things that I want to point out is how the mouth is open in all of these. So when we look at this, and there's no, and my mouth is open, and I actually have the power at this moment, because I am speaking, air is coming out. Many of you are standing and your mouths are closed. You have really valuable ideas and things, and I'm hoping that they're going to come out in the conversations in the Twitter and other places there. But the thing is that when my mouth is open, I have power. You have power. And what we see here, no matter whether it's rage, whatever those expressions are, that these faces here, they are faces of having power, just as in there, the air is coming out of her mouth there. Think about the symbolism of power in her work and how it is represented differently in the different works here. There's also in the power play pieces, there's a great deal of female form that is suggested within the bodies coming together. So when you look at the whole series, you're going to see that. Sometimes it's between spaces and such. you can see that in some areas. You know, you'll see it in different ways, and you'll find these shapes and forms in which she's in some ways conflating masculine and feminine, and perhaps thinking about earlier than the piece over there, the 2007, is that cruelty can actually, that we're all capable of cruelty. So it's not about gender. But yes, that's the idea of voice, air, speaking, power. Let's finish up with these two pieces, spending a little bit of time with this and then this piece over here.
When you convinced her or spoke to her about bringing her material here, and she agreed, had she been here to visit?
Not yet.
Before she gave the stuff to the library, she had not been here.
That's right.
That's interesting.
Yes. She had not been. The question was, had Judy Chicago been to Penn State? No, but I had visited her and spent, and so I was she identified me with Penn State because I had met with her since 2000. My first email was 2001. Actually visited her in 2002. So over a decade of communication with her and working with her and actually seeing her teaching in 2003, the whole semester out there in Pomona and such. So she believed me when I said Penn State was a place to bring her archives. So she trusted me and believed me. And I'm, you know, thrilled that, that's the case. In this work, the cartoon for the fall, it's from her Holocaust project, From Darkness into Light, and it's the cartoon for a tapestry. And a tapestry was very purposeful. Remember, I talked about the materials that she used is very purposeful, and because she felt that the medium shows how the Holocaust, this is out of her words here, how the Holocaust grew out of the very fabric of Western civilization. This is her story of Western civilization. It starts from here, and it goes to that direction as one would read. Would read, and reading along the bottom, she gives a little bit of reference to what's going on here. But I thought it would be good for you to kind of look at this piece here and tell me what you are seeing in here about this fall, Western civilization fall, what story you are seeing. I think if you think about in terms of Judy Chicago, and one of the things that she was devalued about within the art world is her work, she wanted it to speak to everybody. She wanted you to be able to read and understand and interpret her work. There's other levels you could interpret it and go deeper, but she wanted it to be accessible. Art world likes to have experts in art speak, she calls it, to interpret. So only if you are really smart within art can you really understand the value of this piece. She debunked that. And which was not really very favored within the art world. So she's trying to make something very accessible here. And this piece points out a lot about power and dominance and her symbolism of those kind of notions. Anyone want to point out some aspects of this story that you think is going on here? Anyone want to give it a try to kind of read this?
I want to know why the last two figures up on the right have horns, especially the Jewish figure that looks like horns on his head, which is one of the things that we object to. Or is it a fish? What is it up there?
I think I don't think I can answer that because I think it relates to a Jewish iconography that I'm not versed on, but I will investigate that. And I hope you do as well. Does anybody have knowledge from something within Jewish history that could help interpret that right there. Because she also, she's done, spent like 8 years in doing this series of the Holocaust Project. It's not a series, the project. She has done a lot of research into her Jewish heritage. So there are symbolisms that if you have a Jewish heritage, you would be able to read that. And, you know, if you've studied that. So
it could be that she's saying that the Jews were demonized by the Nazis.
It could very well be.
It's also the iconography for Moses.
Okay, so that's what I'm thinking, that there is an iconography that she's looking at. She goes to, you know, a lot of sites, concentration, former concentration camps, museums, studies, books, and such to look, to find the imagery that helps convey the story. And so we see this sort of mechanism, this machine-like, and industrialization, time, and such, and this kind of, in the process of doing that, it's like this slaughter, killing of pigs, equating to killing of people into the furnaces of the Holocaust. So it's really the downfall, it's the fall. Here, so we see this. She talks about the ideas of enlightenment and the Renaissance as being quite narrow and not including women. There's this fight going on here.
I also think it's interesting with the reference to the demonizing of the Jews. If you look at the figure to the left, I almost read that as the demonizing of women and how it's tied to this very feminine symbol of the making of the yarn, the wheel there.
Yes. There she talks about how the weaving that is sort of like spun the world into existence is at this time now becoming more of an industrialized trap of factory work and poor conditions for particularly women. She talks about how the kinds of things like tapestry, which were guilds and groups of men and women working together, becoming a separate kind of space for exploitation of women workers at this stage here. So there's kind of multiple references in a lot of the symbolism here. And what she would like, and I, you know, really like the, when you talked about demonizing, I really like how you brought that together, because she really wants us to be able to read this from our experiences, from what we know and our knowledge. So I wanted to be able to answer accurately, but she is open for all sorts of kinds of interpretations.
I think when I see the what I know about the Holocaust and having visited some of those concentration camps as well, that it's a lot about propaganda, and it's how you weave the lies and make the stories that one wants to, and so therefore as a consequence, so you're weaving a lie and a web of lies that ultimately have this particular outcome.
Yeah, excellent. So, what kind of power, and who has the power along the way? What are some symbols of power within here? And how is power corrupt or empowering within this piece?
What's interesting to me is that the men in the picture are either black or gray, shades of gray, and the women are in color.
Life, yes, and that's very much part of the symbolism here, this darkness, or no color.
I'm taken with the face that's hidden there. Mm-hmm. Mother Earth would be my interpretation of that.
There's a tear coming out of that.
Those are all kind of similar to the three faces. All of those forms are female body images there in the ground. Torsos.
Yeah. You see this kind of folds and the silhouettes kind of and full of color and life, but sadness as well, as the abundance of the earth, becomes more and more, controlled, and agriculture, and then a whole kind of system of ownership comes about when people are not gathering food, but are storing it up. So you own the land, and then you own the silos of the grains and such, and it's really a change within society. So she would do these designs, and then would have collaborative groups of women that she would look at their samplers, and they would volunteer to create the tapestries, the kind of skills. And she found that she could actually really design well for fabric and tapestry, and she actually doesn't know where she got those skills from, but she's able to do that. And then sometimes the work has transferred into, and particularly this series, into stained glass windows. So she works in glass, as you saw the Mary Queen of Scots over there, working in all kinds of materials. And some of the things, like the glass, she just studied, went up to Seattle and just studied up there with the glass blowers up there and such to really understand the materials. So she often uses a material that best conveys her ideas. Many artists, I'm a ceramist, I work in clay, that's it. And so you see the diversity of materials, and those materials have great import to the meaning of all of her work. And I want to, as the focus is on futures of feminist past, I want to focus our attention on this series right here, 1994 to 2000. It's called Resolutions, A Stitch in Time. And she uses these age-old adages, like hitch your wagon to the star. And she redoes both our ways of thinking about these resolutions or adages. She changes our ways of thinking about that, or a future way of thinking about it, and also fabric and tapestry, or quilting, in this case here at applique, to have us sort of, relook to bring this into contemporary times, these ideas, and to move them forward. So when we look at this, hitch your wagon to a star, come up close, you see, this this fabric, different kinds of processes of painting on the fabric, sewn, applique, stitch the applique there with the title of Hitch Your Wagon to a Star. So this piece was 2000, created in 2000, and I'd like to spend our last few moments thinking about, so if it's Hitch Your Wagon to a Star, what might that star be today? How might we, because it's an idea of how to make change, what might that star be in order to make change? What might we hitch our wagon to? If we think about what I've talked about here, we can see some of the things that Judy Chicago hitched her wagon to. She looked at women throughout time, and they became role models for her. They gave her strength. A lot of times when she was working on many of her works, but Dinner Party in particular, and then all the stuff that happened after that, because she was completely broke and had to start totally over after the Dinner Party with everything, with her life. And even though all these museums made so much money, it showed first in 1979 in San Francisco, they even named a cash register Judy because they made so much money. But in 2010 in a large book about San Francisco's Museum of Art, their history. There's one little black and white in the timeline of the dinner party, which is a significant piece. 2010, she is still fighting that erasure and omission, but she continues. She continues to, that's why I say she just does not give up. And so she continues to look at these women who, in all this adversary, had difficulties, but continued their work and we have benefited in the future. So, in concluding thoughts, what might you think we hitch our wagon? What stars might we have in order? And I think we need to move that away from not the Hollywood stars, not in the individual people in those ways, but what might those stars as maybe ideas and entities and such that we need to hitch our wagon to help us go forward, to help us make change towards justice and equity. Any ideas at all what, either what you think Judy might have hitched her wagon to, or she's suggesting from this imagery here, what we could hitch our wagon to? What does the star mean?
Is just, well, just this piece of people, women working together. I think that meant a lot to her.
Mm-hmm. I think so. So we don't see an individual in there. I mean, within the star, there's four people in hands all kind of together, and they're very close.
Right.
And there's sort of a range of kinds of people there, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other readings of this piece, you know, and she's, you know, taking, here's this wagon, she gives us this wagon, but that brings us in the sense of together,
yeah,
journey together. There's not one star either up above.
I think the symbolism of the colors, we don't need to be simple, but we can, all of us work together as women. It doesn't matter what our nationality is or who we are.
And as men, there are men in here, a boy and man.
Together we conquer, and alone we don't.
Right, and the rainbow has been a symbol of openness to difference in a lot of different ways, but particularly of homosexuality, and so the idea of sexuality being broader and the kinds of ways that people configure families and relationships and find support and dealing with sexuality. So the rainbow is, that's one interpretation, can mean a lot of things. The rainbow as idea of hope, just like the butterfly, symbol of liberation and freedom and such, which, again, these kind of symbols and even these resolutions, this would be her professors, her art teachers that she had would like be still telling her not to use those symbolisms, not to use those colors, and the possibility that we might be able to read and understand some of these ideas. But it's always an open thing because, you know, what the star is not defined for us either. You know, it's put out there as for us to think about, but it's not locked down to this is what we need to hitch our wagon to. It is open. Any other comments or thoughts about, and I just kind of maybe should just leave to you the notion of what do you want to hitch your wagon to? And that's the futures of feminist past. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for holding up.
You're welcome.
And I welcome any kind of questions, but I know that I think there's the talk right at 1 o'clock, so you might want to slip out to that one as well. Thank you. Just save this here.
Hi. I was just a